For more presentations like this, visit www.xenos.org.
Well, this is time for the new winter series. It's January, after all. And I thought what we would do this winter is something that I've given a lot of thought to over the years and just decided to pull the trigger on it here recently and do a series of studies that focus on the nature of God. You know, what is God really like? And want to do that through the book of Exodus. So we're going to be in the Old Testament for the next few months. And tonight we're going to be in Exodus chapter 3, verses 1 through 15. It's the famous burning bush story, and I'll give you some background on that in just a minute. But what I want to do tonight is to take a step back first to get you acclimated to why do a study like this? Why spend 3 months together really working through a narrative piece of Scripture and trying to understand the issue of who is God? What is God like? And really, it seems to me that there are three reasons why this is, I think, of critical importance. And the first is that I think that in our society today, well, it's true of all generations and all people in all places, but it's poignant, I think, in our time, that survey after survey shows that 95, 96, 97% of adult Americans believe that there is such an individual, such a being, force, however they define it, as God. But for the overwhelming majority of people, their sense of who God is extremely vague. It's not something that could be really defined. Who is God? Is God some sort of cosmic force like energy that pervades material things? Is God, you know, the old man on the throne kind of image? Is God, you know, the cosmic cop that's getting ready to bust you every time you get out of line? I think that we have images of who God is. And the question is, do those images and those assumptions and those thoughts about who God is really correspond to an actually existing God who is out there? And it seems to me as well that there are enormous, enormous implications to this. Because if we have only the vaguest sense for who is God, and we just cannot really find the language to express our concepts of who God is, then we have a very profoundly unsatisfying faith. I mean, how do you find hope and purpose, comfort and direction in some sort of an abstraction that you cannot really define? And so I think that this is the dilemma for the vast majority of our culture today, even many who would call ourselves Christians, still have just a very confused sense of who God is. And the notion of God seems like a very distant and relatively irrelevant one as well. We've been going around to some coffee shops recently doing some interviews. And so I thought, rather than me prattling on about how people think and how they express themselves, I'd give you just an example of that. Check this out.
I'm fairly agnostic. I don't know at this point. I feel like there has to be something, but then again, I feel that it could be a radically different thing than, you know, I definitely do not believe in God in the way that God is traditionally thought of. So, but I feel like there's something. There's maybe it's just the energy in the world. The order, the logic, the logos, to use a philosophy term. I'm hesitant to even say that it's a thinking, rational being. I'm more inclined to say that it's you and I and this chair. I don't think that I'm in line with God right now. And I don't mean that in the sense that I break the Ten Commandments, because I don't think that that's, you know, I feel like being in touch with God is not something that is exactly principled, because it's completely in the moment. When you are out of line with God, you're experiencing dissonance. There's something wrong, and you know it now. And it's not, you know, you carry it with you at all times when you're out of line with God. And again, it's not necessarily something that you can say in advance, oh, if you do this, you're going to be out of line with God. Or, you know, if you do these things, you're going to be in line. I'm tempted to say that it can't be described. So, but then again, there's something in me that wants to say that yes, it can. And I would say it's more of a feeling than anything else. And a good feeling. I obviously don't have something formulated in my mind, because I don't even think of it as like a tangible thing. I'm intellectually inclined to say it's ineffable, but at the same time, the fact that it's feelable makes me feel like maybe it is explainable. No. Or at least you can't know that mine are, and I can't know that yours are. But maybe you can on an individual basis. Maybe when you've eliminated all dissonance in you. But then again, I mean, even on that level, I don't think that you can ever. I could just be completely deluded. That is some meddlesome thing that just, you know, it's like, oh, I'm not in any biblical sense. I'm using that word too loosely, but I don't think that, you know, God calls Moses up to the top of Mount Sinai and says, oh, here are the Ten Commandments. I mean, I think that's absurd. But I mean, I think that from this idea that I've been espousing, you could say that yes, any time that God is in each and every one of us, that we are God in a sense, then of course it's played a role in human affairs. I think on the deepest level, it does not matter. And that sincerity is all that matters. But I think that people might be sincere and be deluded at the same time, and so it's not a true sincerity. I think it matters. It's everything. Everything. I mean, it's happiness. It's your well-being, I would say, would depend on that.
We got a lot to think about here. This dude's confused. This dude's me. Through a lot of my life, I listen to this guy and think, I thought that thought. I thought that thought. You know, and the dilemma of on the one hand saying with real sincerity and honesty, yes, I think having a relationship with God is everything. But then coming to this question of, well, who is God? And having no words, no concept, nothing to grasp onto, nothing to trust, nothing to draw wisdom from, nothing to lean on, nothing to give hope. That is our culture. That's many of you here tonight. And so I think that we will find ourselves well served thinking in a very careful and systematic way through the narrative of Exodus, who is God? And to try to answer these very deep, real, authentic, probing, and I think tragic responses that this young man gave. So we need to think about that. It's not just that not being able to understand who God really is unsatisfying. The reality is that there is really a lot at stake. Personally, conceptually, you know, you think about this, belief in God and an understanding of who God is really the kind of foundation point for the building of our whole view of what is real, what is true, what does it mean for me to be human. These are the categories that we operate out of. How do we know that something's right or wrong? How do we know that humankind has any kind of inherent dignity or value to make notions of civil justice meaningful or plausible or tenable? What about the purpose for my own life? You know, these are questions that are deeply theological, if you will. And everybody, it doesn't matter what you believe, operates out of certain assumptions in this area. And I would like to put forth to you that if we understand the nature of God as He truly is, it gives meaning and texture and significance to these very deep questions that all of us, by virtue of our humanity, must ask ourselves. And then I think, too, as we get into the study of who is God, there's another thing that we might sense within ourselves. Namely, that kind of voice in the back of our head that says, I'm not really sure I want to know. Because understanding God for who He is means that we, in some ways, must come into confrontation with who we are as well. And I think that it's the human tendency for us to create God in our own image. A God that's convenient, a God that fits in with my game plan, the way I want to live, the way I view myself, the way I want to view other people. And, you know, that's sort of a big deal. And the Bible, in fact, says that that's really at the heart of humanity in the state that we are in. I was reading, my son has taken up a very bad habit. He's studying philosophy. And I've warned him and everything else, but he won't listen. So the little rebel is doing that down at OSU. And so we have all these conversations and stuff, because that's an area of interest for me as well. And so he gives me this autobiography of the 20th century's probably most notorious atheist, Jean-Paul Sartre. And he said, Dad, I think you'll find this pretty interesting. I got into it, and I found out what he meant by it. It's pretty interesting. Here's this guy who, at 18 years old, decisively concludes God does not exist. Why? Because to admit that God exists is a limitation on my freedom. I can't be my own God. And so he's reasoning from the bottom line up. There's no argument here. It's just a disposition of the heart that says there's not room for you and me. So you're going to have to go. Well, I think, you know, some of us have gone that far. Maybe some of us are there here tonight. You know, I just can't believe in God because He doesn't fit into my scheme. But I think also a lot of us have real honest, deep questions about, you know, who God is. And this is a barrier for us to really moving forward in our pursuit of God. Is God really good? You know, what do we think about a God who executes judgment on people? And I think that rather than thinking this through and assessing what does the Bible say about this, that there's something within us that just doesn't want to have anything to do with it. And so we flee. And to that extent, our conceptions of God become deeply distorted. So our purpose over this next 3 months is to discover God, not as we choose to see Him, but as He has chosen to show Himself to us. And so what we're talking about here, basically, is the idea of revelation. That here this young man, just with his own intuitions, with his own reading and so forth, really recognizes, I'm shooting in the dark. I can't tell you who God is or what God is like. Whatever answer I have would just be a reflection of my own limited perspective, my cultural conditioning, whatever it might be. And I think that that's a very honest and very true answer to give. If that's all we have, my reasoning, my experiences, my cultural conditioning, yeah, I think we are left in the dark. But what if, and this is the assumption unique to biblical faith, that God actually has revealed Himself to human beings in space and time, that is, in history. We're going to study Exodus, which is a window into who God is, how God revealed himself to one generation in a particular point in time. And we're not going to spend a lot of time on building the historical foundation for this narrative. We could do that, but it would take us well beyond what we have time to do. I want us to say, look, let's assume that what we're reading here is real history, and it is real history. There's phenomenal reason to believe that that's the case. What is God showing us? What is God telling us about who he is, and what are the implications for our lives? So I think that this is a very important point, the need to know, but also not just the need to know who God is, what God is like, but also, and very importantly, to be connected to God. We don't want to just have some kind of academic study of who is God, like, you know, what does it mean to be this table? It's four legs, it's got a surface, it's round. Isn't that interesting? Well, it is interesting in a certain narrow kind of way, but it's not very interesting to me. And it's not very motivating either. And what I think we need to understand is the personhood of God as it comes so richly out in this great narrative. God's motivations, his heart's desires, the things that bring God joy and that drive him to anger, and the internal workings of who God is, because uniquely the Bible declares God is a person. God is a personal being, and we want to explore how the personhood of God manifests itself in human history in the context of the Exodus narrative. And how, by extension, is the human relationship with God to be expressed. And so we're going to spend a lot of time in Exodus, but we're also going to talk out of Psalms and other sources in the Old Testament that give commentary and response to the events, the historical events that take place in the Exodus. And the reason why that's so valuable is because in the prayers of the great people of the Bible, both New and Old Testament, and in the Psalms, when I've been reflecting on this, I'm realizing that they have something real going with God that is stimulated by something very different from the way that I tend to approach God. My tendency is to approach God basically saying, well, God, here's my list, and can you do this for me, and how about that thing over there, and I'm concerned about this, can you lend a hand, and I've got all these things that I'm intensely interested that God do in my life for me, and some of them are really great things, and some of them probably aren't. And I'm not saying that God's not interested, because he is. But the overwhelming emphasis in the scripture when people are interacting with God is that they focus on the attributes of God, the nature of God. They focus on who God is, the goodness of God, the mercy of God, the compassion of God, the power of God. All of these things, and what that does is it begins to mold our thinking and shaping what does it mean for me to relate to this God. And the consequence of that is that we begin to develop real connection with him. You know, when you interact with your spouse and with you, what you bring to the table is your grocery list of items that you want them to do for you, my sense is, not that I would know this from experience, is that, that you have a nice contractual relationship, but it's not very personal. It's not very rewarding. It's not very deep. Whereas on the other hand, if you're able to sit down with your spouse to say, you know, what I really dig about you is this. You know, you are sensitive, you are compassionate in a way that just challenges my heart towards people. You are, a person who cares about the details of life in a way that I don't. And what happens is that enables you to serve people and make them understand that you care for them, that they matter to you. I appreciate that about you. You know, and to be able to come in a relationship with things that are concrete and specific like that changes the whole framework of how that relationship feels. And it's like that with God. And so each week as we talk through various facets of who is God, we're going to be bringing this element to the table. What does it mean to respond to God and to relate to Him on the basis of the fact that He is this way? And then finally, we want to spend some time talking about the effect of knowing God. Because if you know God, you will be changed by God. What does it look like to be increasingly more like Him? He's going to rub off on you if you get to know Him and you pursue your relationship with Him. And there's a term that the Bible uses for that. It's called godliness. And what it's, that's kind of a religious term in our day, and it's kind of something like we don't want to be like that. But in the biblical description of it, it's something that's super inviting. It means that God has shaped you and molded who you are, your values, your character, your aspirations, your thinking, your heart. And you've become more like Him. And as such, more like He intended you to be. And as such, more able, more effective in your dealings with other people. More rewarding in your relationships. So to me, this study is so cool. There's a lot at stake. And we just want to walk through it kind of bite at a time. But tonight we're going to get the whole piece out of the oven and take a look. Because we need some framework and we need some context. And we need a little background specifically to the narrative of Exodus that we're going to be looking at. And I want to say just a few things about that. The first is that Exodus is the second book of the Old Testament, and it is a story that relates to Genesis specifically because in Genesis chapter 12, God comes to this guy Abraham at about 2000 BC, and He says, Abraham, I want to make you a promise. And that promise is that, you know, I'm going to bless you and all that kind of stuff, which is really cool. But what I really want you to understand is that I'm going to make a great nation to come out of you, and I'm going to give you this land, Canaan, what later becomes Israel. And, oh, by the way, it's going to be 400 years till that happens. Because I'm working with the native population there, and I don't foresee myself being done for some time. So in the meantime, I'm going to take you down to Egypt, and I'm going to put you in Goshen, this northeastern area of Egypt, and you'll be left alone, and you'll be able to go from a small nuclear family into this enormous incubator that will create at the end of that a nation of people. However, I will bless your descendants to such an extent that they will actually pose a threat to their Egyptian hosts. And those Egyptian hosts who've kind of looked on you approvingly for a while are going to enslave you. And so you're going to be slaves there. But don't worry, because I'm going to come and I'm going to get you. I'm going to rescue you. And so the whole book of Exodus simply is God's rescue mission for His people living in captivity. And the narrative really focuses on this guy who was a moral crusader, an advocate for his people, this guy named Moses. And he's going to go out there and he's going to stick up for his oppressed fellow countrymen. But he's going to fail because he doesn't have the resources. He doesn't have the tools to bring this great nation together. And so he goes out into the wilderness, dejected, a man who is now living a life more or less of quiet despair. I see the problem. I don't have the solution. And God, of course, knew that. And God is going to meet Moses. And when these two guys come together, something really profound begins to take shape. Let's pick up the narrative. This is Exodus chapter 3, verse 1. It says, Moses was pastoring the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the west side of the wilderness and came to Horeb, which later is called Mount Sinai, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him in a blazing fire from the midst of the bush, and he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, yet the bush was not consumed. So Moses said, I must turn aside now and see with this marvelous sight why the bush is not burned up. And when the Lord saw that he had turned aside, God called him from the midst of the bush, saying, Moses, Moses. And Moses said, Here I am. Then God said, Do not come near here. Remove your sandals from your feet, for the place on which you're standing is holy ground. And he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And then Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look at God. And the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt, and have given heed to their cry because of their taskmasters. For I am aware of their suffering, and I have come down to deliver them from the power of the Egyptians, and to bring them up from the land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey. Now behold, the cry of the sons of Israel has come to me. Furthermore, I have seen the oppression with which the Egyptians are oppressing them. Therefore, come now, and I will send you to Pharaoh so that you may bring out my people, the sons of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? And God said, Certainly I will be with you. And this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God at this mountain. Then Moses said to God, Behold, I'm going to the sons of Israel, and they shall say, and I shall say to them, The God of your fathers has sent me to you. But now they may say to me, Well, what is his name? And what shall I say to them? And God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Furthermore, God said, Thus you shall say to the sons of Israel, The Lord, the God of your fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, has sent me to you. This is my name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. And so here we have the burning bush. Here we have this moment of revelation, this moment in which God invades human history and discloses who he is to a man, and later to nations. And the focus I want to bring our attention to is his name. Who shall I say has sent me to you? Tell them, I am has sent me to you. Well, like the old question, what's in a name? You know, most of us choose to name our children because we like the sound. It flows well, you know what I'm saying? If you have a long last name, then a short first name is always better. But in the Old Testament world, in the ancient world, names really capture the essence of a person. And so, like, for instance, Jacob. Why is Jacob called Jacob? Well, Jacob means basically a shifty, conniving liar. And what was Jacob really like? Well, he was like a shifty, conniving liar. And so, titles are given because they capture the essence of who a person is. And so it is with God as well, that he's described by many terms: El Shaddai, the Lord Most High, Elohim, the Lord of Hosts, and various things like that. But now he comes and he says, okay, at the heart, in essence, what's my name? Who am I? And he says, I am, which is in Hebrew the imperfect present tense verb to be. Now, what does that mean in translation? Since you probably have forgotten your grammar a few years ago. It means this. Yahweh is the literal rendering of that expression, I am. And it means, I am the one who always is. And that is Yahweh. That is the God of the Bible, the God of the Old Testament, the one true God. I am He who always will be. What does that mean? Let's think about that a little bit. It means first that God is infinite, that He lives in the infinite eternal present. That's what the verb tense demands, that He always exists fully in every moment. He is eternal. That is to say, that while He exists fully, there's no time in which God has not been who He is. And there will never be a time in the future when God will not be who He is. The point, if we could use a term to express this, is that God is transcendent. That God transcends space and time. That God is not limited by space and time. And this is fascinating to historians who study it. Because when you look out at the ancient Near Eastern world, in fact, when you look out at any known culture of antiquity, in fact, when you look out at any known culture today, there is only one concept of a transcendent personal God, and that is the one rooted in the Bible. And what does it mean, and why is that significant? And interestingly, where does it come from? You know, historians have done a lot of work on the evolution of religious ideas, the concepts of God that grow within a culture. The weird thing about a God who is infinite and eternal and transcends space and time is that there is no cultural antecedent for it. At all. At all. He comes out of no context into the theater of human life. And I want us to think in terms of the significance of that by contrasting an infinite personal God with the ancient Near Eastern gods that we could call polytheistic, gods of particular parts of nature. So you have a sun god, a moon god, a god of fertility, a god of the ocean, a god of the sea, gods that inhabit crops, and so forth. The gods of the ancient world are numerous, fickle, severe, amoral, just like the forces of nature that they represent. How profoundly different this is from Yahweh. Because these are beings, personifications of nature. They're not transcendent. They're a part of the ebb and flow of the natural order. And as a consequence, the worship of these deities really revolves around fear and control. The forces of nature cannot be manipulated by man. So we personify them and appeal to them as gods. And that's the heart of ancient religious practice, absolutely everywhere, but among these ancient Hebrews. In some ways, I think that this polytheistic view is a very contemporary one. And if you were listening to our friend at the outset of our discussion tonight, who is God for him? Some all-pervading spirit that's a part of all matter. You know, how different is that than really what we're talking about here in terms of the ancient religious ideas? Really not very different at all, except for he can't put a name and a face to it. It's all very much the same. And there are important implications to our understanding of, is there an infinite personal God? Let's think about it just a little bit. If all we have is nature and finite, limited nature spirits, where is the place for human dignity and human value? If all we're left with is nature, who's to say that one bag of chemicals is valuable and the other lacks that kind of value and we can go home and eat it for dinner? Where does that distinction come from? And see, this has always been a problem, and this is a problem down to our present day, that inherently, internally, all human beings believe that life matters, that life is valuable, and so it does. But what provides the basis for us to say that human life is valuable, that human life is significant? Could it be, just as Genesis describes it, that man is the image of the infinite personal God? Could it be that that aspect of our nature is what sets us apart from all other things, so that we can speak meaningfully about human dignity and human rights and so forth? Do you understand what I'm saying? There is a lot at stake in I am that I am. If all we are is a part of nature, if all we do is ebb and flow with the natural world, if all we are is a bag of chemicals that take one shape today and another shape tomorrow, there is no base for human value. And as a consequence, as the pressures and demands of history bear upon a people, inevitably, the notion of human dignity is lost. We have to assume certain people are non-persons, non-human, and then we are allowed to take their life. The Holocaust of the 1940s. And it just goes on and on and on. And on what basis can we say that your life is valuable? It doesn't matter who you are or what your deficits are. You have value. There is no way to capture that outside of the notion that we are connected and in the image of and have the capacity to know the infinite personal God who made us. Further, if all we have is the material order, even if we deify it in some way, how can we find a basis for ethics beyond satisfying our own natural desires, the survival of the fittest? You know, nature's not good or bad, right or wrong, it just is. It just is. And I'm not suggesting for a moment that if you are an atheist, that you are an immoral person. And that if you are a person of faith in the Bible, that somehow you are a moral person. Tragically, in my experience, it's often flip-flopped. But not always. The point here is not whether individuals are relatively better than others. The question that we want to get at is, is there even a basis for us to talk in terms of right and wrong, good and bad, just and unjust, and things of this nature? What would that require? It would require that we have a reality that is beyond the merely natural order. Well, there's only one place you can find that, folks. That's in the infinite personal God of Scripture. If God is infinite and he is good, then he's infinitely good. The good doesn't change from day to day or person to person or place to place. It's stable, it's objective, and we can talk meaningfully about it. If all we have is nature, then there can be no life beyond the mundane. You know what mundane means? We think of mundane as the trivial, right? Oh, I'm into a real rut. So mundane. Life's so mundane. The word mundane really just comes from the Latin. It means earthly. That's all it means. And what it conveys is the idea that if all we're seeking for in the purpose of our life is what we can experience in the moment, that we will not be able to satisfy the thirst for significance, the thirst for meaning that drives all human beings, just like this young man, I think, so inarticulately expressed in our video piece. Grasping to understand, I know that my life matters, but I cannot tell you in any way why. And that is a tragedy. And the book of Exodus is a remedy. Because in it we will find the infinite personal God who makes sense out of all of our correct intuitions about our significance, about our dignity, about the fact that life has real purpose, that there are such things as right and wrong and so forth. I am that I am. The infinite nature of God means that what is true of God is infinitely true. There are no limitations to any part of who God is. If God is love, He's infinitely love. If God is merciful, He's infinitely merciful. If God is powerful, He is infinitely powerful. And so on. But it also speaks to the otherliness of God. The eternality of God is unique. It speaks to God's perfection. He's not going through a process of getting better. He's perfectly pure morally in every moment of time. And this is a term that the Bible refers to as holiness. And so you'll remember in the story, when Moses approaches the burning bush, what does the angel say to Moses before he's entitled to talk to God? Hey, bub, take off your shoes. The ground on which you're standing is holy ground. You know, God's not like us. When we create gods in our own image, they're gods that don't have a problem with me, right? But not the infinite personal God of Scripture. His being is perfect. Mine is not. And so there's a sacredness about God that this text, I think, really pounds out in a deep way, as we'll see from week to week. And that knowing our place in relationship to an all-perfect, transcendent, moral being, the response to that is fear, the fear of God. And sometimes that means a real dread, like, oh my God. And other times it means, you are so awesome, God. I can't even hardly put into words how fantastic you are. But that's the point, is that when we know God for who He is, then we know our place. And if we want to relate to God, we relate to God as a creature, an utterly contingent creature, relates to the awesome, almighty, eternal person of God. And there's just a huge gulf between. God's not like us. He's not just a whole lot more of what we are. He's totally transcends who we are. Moses reflected deeply on this revelation of God to him, I am who I am, in Psalm 90. And he says, Yahweh, you have been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or before you gave birth to the earth and the world, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Okay, so that's just a poetic expression of God's infinite nature. But then he draws the implications to that. God, I'm just amazed that you are this way. It's so profound that you're not like anything else. And so he responds in verse 12, so teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. And it is the wise person who lives their life in the light of the infinite personal God who is there. Because it is in the light of that God who reveals himself in history and who will reveal himself to you that your days make sense. And so this is what Moses is saying. This is not just an abstract exercise. It matters that God is eternal. It matters that he's infinite, because I can make sense out of my day to day in the light of who he is. Secondly, and lastly, when we talk about I am Yahweh, clearly it is the God who speaks. Okay, it's God who speaks forth from from the burning bush. God's not some impersonal, that, you know, what does that mean? I don't know. What does it mean to you? I don't know. It's kind of frustrating. But God, because he's personal, speaks. He expresses himself. He expresses his person. He expresses his will and his purpose. The God who speaks. God desires true communication. And we are capable of having true communication with God because we have been created in God's image. Our rational faculties, our moral faculties, our sense of conscience, our consciousness itself, these are all things that God breathed into our bodies, made us capable of having real communication with him. And as a consequence, when God works to reveal himself in history, history is his story. It's through how we recognize his work and how he discloses himself that we understand deeper and in a more deep way, you know, what does it mean for us to deal with this kind of God? He says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. By that work, I'm not a God who just sits and smokes his pipe up in heaven and twiddles his thumb and plays an occasional chess piece with his creation. I'm involved, I'm invested, I'm there, he says. Now we come to this really bizarre, I thought bizarre, comment from Moses. This is in verse 13. He says, now Israel may say to me when I come to him, so what's his name? What am I supposed to say to him? That's when he says, I am who I am. And this has given people over the years a lot of confusion. But I think really what he's asking and the significance of this narrative is lost through cultural translation. That Moses is not asking a question born out of ignorance as though Israel did not know the name of their God. But he's asking instead, how will Yahweh make himself known to the nation and to the world around them? See, God has been revealing himself to individuals up to this point, to Abraham, to Isaac, to Jacob, to Joseph, now to Moses. Now God's going to reveal himself to a whole nation. And Moses is asking, God, how do you intend to put yourself forward to the nation? Knowing, in this sense, means experiencing or witnessing. It's not, again, the abstract question, what's your name, God? It's, how will you manifest yourself in our experience that we can witness? And this is borne out repeatedly in the narrative. It's very important. He says in verse 15, Yahweh is my memorial name forever, and this is my memorial name to all generations. What he's saying is, I am going to involve myself in history in a way that I never have before. And the world will never be the same after this Exodus event. And how am I going to reveal myself? Look what he says in Exodus 6, verse 7. He says, that you shall know that I am Yahweh your God, who brought you up out of the burdens of Egypt. He says, I want you to have experience of deliverance. That's the purpose of this narrative, this revelation. And he says in chapter 7, verse 5, in the context of the upcoming plague stories, which we'll talk about in a few weeks, the Egyptians will know that I am Yahweh when I stretch out my hand and bring out the sons of Israel. They didn't care about the name on his sticker on his chest. He's revealing his power and who he is in this moment of history to them. And ultimately, indeed, to a very fearful Moses. Moses, who stands between the infinite personal God who speaks and the people who God has called upon Moses to be his instrument to lead them forward. A daunting task. But God says to Moses, certainly I will be with you. And this shall be the sign to you that it is I who have sent you. that when you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall worship God in this mountain. That's Mount Sinai he's talking about, again, in the context of the burning bush. I want to reveal myself again to you, Moses, is what God is saying. And so we find in Exodus chapter 34, after the Red Sea has been parted, after the plagues, after the Passover, after all these things, and Israel's led out into the desert, that Moses goes into the mountain, and just as God had promised, there is a revelation. Passed by in front of Moses and proclaimed, Yahweh, Yahweh God. In your translations, it probably says Lord in small capitals. That's Yahweh. Lord, Lord God, compassionate and gracious, slow in anger, and abounding in loving kindness and truth, who keeps loving kindness for thousands, who gives, forgives iniquity, transgression, and sin. Yet he will not leave the guilty unpunished, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children and on the grandchildren of the third and fourth generations. And so it says, Moses made haste to bow down toward the earth in worship. Like, oh my God. You are that God, aren't you? And you have demonstrated all of who you are in my own experience. You know, this is the God of the Exodus. He is compassionate and merciful. He's got a really long fuse. He's abounding in loving kindness and truth. You know, it's not like only a certain privileged access. He really means that for all and any. He keeps, it says, his loving kindness for thousands. You know, he cares. He continues to care for people and to meet their needs. That's the providence of God, who forgives iniquity. It's not like we deserve his favor, but he gives it to us because he's merciful and he's prepared to forgive. And he will not leave the guilty unpunished without consequences to injustice and to evil. The term is irrelevant. And so he is a God of justice as well. And we'll be pounding out these ideas, these representations of who God is over these next 3 months as we get into this narrative. It's a wonderful study. And I want to say just one more thing about it here, which is that Exodus really is biblical history's pattern. That all of the concepts about who is God, the concept of who are human beings before God and what is our standing before God, the idea of redemption, for instance, it finds its meaning in Exodus. And so it shouldn't surprise us to know that the picture of God that we have, the picture of the world that we're given in these short chapters of the book of Exodus, will reverberate throughout the pages of biblical history. Because the condition of man, even though maybe not enslaved to Egypt, is still in a condition of slavery. And so in Isaiah chapter 11, the prophet looks to the southern kingdom now in captivity in Babylon. And he says, a second exodus has been granted to you. And that would evoke then all of the images of who God is to these men and women living now in exile, and real hope and real promise. And in Isaiah 19, as Isaiah looks to the end of human history, he says the most remarkable thing about God's love and God's plan, not just for Israel, but for all of humanity, where he says in verse 19, in that day, at the end of history, when God will bring history to its completion, there will be an altar of the Lord in the midst of the land of Egypt, and a pillar to the Lord near its border. And it will become a sign and a witness to the Lord of hosts in the land of Egypt, for they will cry to the Lord because of their oppressors. And God will send them a savior and a champion, and he will deliver them. And thus the Lord will make himself known to Egypt, and the Egyptians will know the Lord in that day. And they will worship with sacrifice and offering, and will make a vow to the Lord and will perform it. And the Lord will strike Egypt, striking but healing, so that they will return to the Lord, and he will respond to them and will heal them. Then in that day there will be a highway from Egypt, Israel's first oppressors, to Assyria, Israel's second oppressor, the one who blotted out from history 10 of the 12 tribes of Israel. That's Assyria. And so the Assyrians will come to Egypt and the Egyptians into Assyria, and the Egyptians will worship with the Assyrians. And in that day, Israel will be third party with Egypt and Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the earth, whom the Lord of hosts has blessed, saying, "Blessed is Egypt, my people, and Assyria, the work of my hands, and Israel, my inheritance." To understand the Exodus is to understand the heart of God, the plan of God, the character of God. And it offers us a chance to meet God. You know, I'll close with this fairly important statement by Christ in John chapter 8, verse 56. Referring to his countrymen and interacting with them, Jesus said, "Your father Abraham rejoiced to see my day, and he saw it and was glad." And the Jewish leaders responded, "Look, son, you're not yet 50 years old, and yet you have seen Abraham, now dead for 2,000 years." And Jesus answered, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was born, I am." So God does not merely reveal himself through the events of history. God reveals himself personally in history. And the promise of the Old Testament and the unambiguous claims of Jesus in the New Testament is that Jesus Christ is I am in flesh, inviting you and me and all who will listen to him into a trust relationship with God through his death, his Passover on your part. And so in this great narrative of Exodus, we see the unity of Scripture, the unity of God's plan, the coherence and consistency of who God is from beginning to end. And it's just a wonderful study. So I've gone a little long, but I felt the need to get the introductory thoughts out on the table. Next week, we're going to come back and we're going to talk about the God of compassion and the children of Israel. I think I'll just close this up in prayer. Lord, thank you that you are not just a projection of nature or glorified man. Thank you that you are I am, the infinite personal God of all creation. Thank you that you've chosen to reveal yourself in history. And I pray as we get into this study and we really tease out what it says about you and how this great text is commented on in so many places outside of it, that the knowledge that is breathed in by you into these pages would become personal knowledge to us, as by your Spirit you seek us out and challenge us and reveal yourself to us. I just thank you for the awesome privilege, God, of being a speck of dust beloved by you. Amen.
This study was recorded at Xenos Christian Fellowship and is copyrighted, but you may freely copy and distribute it as long as you keep it intact and do not sell it.